top stories. Over 250 Palestinian protesters are injured in an Israeli attack on a village in the north of the occupied West Bank. Saudi Arabia conducts fresh strikes on Yemen, targeting a residential area in the capital Sana'a and damaging a number of houses. And France registers a record high of over 104,000 COVID-19 infections as it struggles to contain the rapid spread of the Omicron variant. Welcome to the program. Over 250 Palestinian protesters are injured in a fresh Israeli attack on the village of Borqa in the occupied West Bank province of Nablus. Israeli soldiers fired live bullets, rubber-coated rounds, stun grenades, and tear gas to disperse Palestinian protesters. The demonstrators were infuriated by the shutdown of the entrance to their village. The move came as the Israeli army intensified its presence on the Nablus-Jenin road to secure dozens of busloads packed with Israeli settlers. In recent days, Israeli settlers protected by the army have stormed the homes of Palestinian citizens on the outskirts of Borqa. Saudi warplanes conduct fresh airstrikes on Yemen, this time targeting the country's capital, Sana'a. Local media say at least three airstrikes were carried out against the residential area. The attacks left a number of houses damaged, but no casualties have yet been reported. This comes after the Yemeni army said it struck vital and sensitive Saudi sites in retaliation for the kingdom's escalating aggression against its southern neighbor. Army spokesman Yahya Seri says the position in the port city of Jizan were targeted with three state-of-the-art precision-guided missiles. He warned of more, quote, painful operations as long as Saudi Arabia continues its atrocities against Yemen. Riyadh and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015, killing hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians, and causing a dire humanitarian situation there. In Sudan, security forces clash with protesters demonstrating against the October military coup. Riot police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the protesters. That after thousands of demonstrators converged on the presidential palace in the capital to express their anger and demand a civilian rule. A number of protesters were injured. A similar event was also held in Madani, a town south of Khartoum. Authorities cut the internet and telephone lines. The African country has witnessed protests since the military takeover on October the 25th and the arrest of civilian leaders. Rallies are staged despite the reinstatement of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who was ousted in the coup. We've spoken to our correspondent in Khartoum, Mohammed Fazari, for more details about the protests. He says Sudanese protesters are calling for the restoration of civilian governments.
The Sudanese took it to the street of Khartoum, the capital city, and other cities for the second month for protesting against the coup and the army takeover of 25th of October. So they're rejecting even the coup and the deal that signed between General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, Friendly Council leader, and Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. So early morning, the Sudanese security forces blocked all the roads that and bridges lead to the Khartoum and other cities. And before the police used excessive forces and using tear gas to disperse thousands of protesters. Protesters retreat their slogan that no negotiation, no compromise, no power sharing, and add new three no's. They add four no's, which is no legitimacy, in referring to the coup of 25th October. So they insist to continue with the strong determination till the downfall of the coup regime and to restore the full civilian government.
In northeast Somalia, thousands of people have been forced to leave their homes amid soaring clashes between two rival factions of security forces. A local official says most people are leaving after the warring sides resorted to heavy machine guns and mortars in the city of Bosaso. The commercial capital of the semi-autonomous state of Puntland has been rocked by heavy clashes over the past days. Thursday, the United Nations Humanitarian Agency voiced concern over the escalation of violence there. It said more than half of the city's population has left their homes in search of safety. Puntland is one of the five semi-autonomous states in the restive Horn of Africa nation. The Omicron variant of the novel coronavirus is breaking new records in Europe. France logs over 100,000 new COVID cases in a single day, its highest daily tally since the pandemic began. Over 3,200 patients are in intensive care in French hospitals. Neighboring Italy has also seen record new infections for the third day in a row, registering more than 54,000 cases. Omicron accounts for 6 out of 10 coronavirus infections in Portugal and is now confirmed to have become the dominant COVID-19 strain there. In England, the authorities are racing against the clock to vaccinate as many people as possible as the caseload soars. The country's administered over 30 million jabs so far, but the British health minister believes that is not enough. The new COVID variant, Omicron, is impacting almost everything, especially the year-end celebrations. Nearly 6,000 flights are canceled worldwide and thousands more delayed over the Christmas weekend. A website tracking global flights says more than 2,600 flights were scrubbed around the globe on the Christmas Day. That included more than 900 originating from or headed for U.S. airports. Over 4,000 delays were also reported on the same day. The airlines canceling their flights include Lufthansa, Delta, United Airlines, and JetBlue, with their pilots and flight attendants calling in sick or having quarantine after exposure to COVID. Chinese airlines accounted for the highest number of cancellations, with China Eastern scrapping 1,000 flights. After a long and drawn-out period of negotiations, the UK finally left the EU at the end of January 2020, ending its 47-year membership. As part of their divorce package, the two sides agreed to a set of trade rules known as the Northern Ireland Protocol. Goods from Britain are checked at ports in Northern Ireland, which remains in the EU's single market, so trade can move freely across its land border with the Republic of Ireland. But nearly 2 years after Brexit, the UK government says that arrangement is not working. It wants a new deal, and it does not want the European Court of Justice to govern the protocol. The EU is offering to remove some customs checks, but it is calling on the UK to reciprocate in other ways, Said Puraza reports.
It was supposed to ensure seamless trade between the UK and the EU following Brexit, but the Northern Ireland Protocol has become a problem itself. Or has it? Negotiated in 2019, the protocol was aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland, still in the EU's single market, and EU member Republic of Ireland. Instead, it's created a regulatory border in the Irish Sea, which acts as a de facto EU-UK frontier. Now, British goods entering Northern Ireland are subject to EU checks and customs regulations. While some have disliked the protocol from day one, others have found it beneficial.
From a business perspective, the Brexit and vaccines and the protocol has been a good thing for the people of the North of Ireland. Obviously, we have the best of both worlds. But if you listen to a small minority that is being platformed by the media, both in Britain and the North of Ireland here, you would think that the protocol was damaging business.
That small minority are elements in the loyalist or unionist community in Northern Ireland, people who wish their country to remain part of the UK. They feel they have been cut off from the mainland. Before becoming Prime Minister, Boris Johnson had told pro-UK parties that he didn't want to see Northern Ireland left abandoned by a border in the sea.
Now, I have to tell you, no British Conservative government could or should sign up to any such arrangement.
That assurance fell by the wayside. A sense of betrayal prevailed. Protests ensued. To the UK government, that meant changing the goalposts.
The protocol is not working. It's completely lost consent in one community in Northern Ireland. It's not doing the thing it was set up to do, protect the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. In fact, it's doing the opposite.
A fact only admitted after the UK left the EU. The European Union rejected any renegotiation of the deal. Some experts believe the government must have known about the problems ahead from day one of Brexit, calling into question the UK's credibility as an international trading partner.
Well, the UK has absolutely no credibility internationally. We've seen that. The two biggest partners in the world, the EU and the American government, have made statements on how they feel about the UK renegotiating international treaties. So even to make any kind of statement with that the UK have any integrity on the international stage now is laughable. UK have no credibility since the Tory government and Brexit.
Another bone of contention, the UK government's demand to remove the EU's legal oversight role, part of the Northern Ireland Protocol, saying as long as the role of the European Court of Justice continues, the protocol will never survive. But in early December, Prime Minister Johnson's Conservative government reluctantly dropped that demand, at a time when it would appear the majority of people in Northern Ireland want an end to the standoff.
Whether they be Irish unionists or Irish nationalists, of course the Tories have always used unionists for the old divide and conquer strategy here in the North of Ireland. So I think it's just sheer incompetence and of course the arrogance in it.
Things took a turn for the worse for the UK Prime Minister with the December 18 high-profile resignation of his chief Brexit negotiator, David Frost, who was replaced less than 24 hours later by Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, who openly backed remaining in the EU in 2016. She's now tasked with resolving her country's differences with the EU, what nearly 2 years of negotiations by her predecessor failed to do.
The UK blames the EU for being inflexible and worrying too much about the so-called integrity of their single market. And Brussels blames London for trying to scrap an international treaty that it signed nearly 2 years ago. Experts say there's no obvious way out of the ongoing stalemate, meaning that Brexit is not exactly done yet. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Tensions, sanctions, and threats to take more actions were the main features of U.S. foreign policy in 2021. Incumbent President Joe Biden was expected to take a less tense approach towards world affairs than his predecessor, Donald Trump. But disputes persisted and even intensified on multiple fronts.
President Joe Biden, a Democrat, took over the White House from his Republican predecessor, Donald Trump, in January 2021. There were expectations that American foreign policy would see less tensions with allies and adversaries under Biden. But that didn't happen, and at times, tensions grew further, like those with China. In fact, the rivalry with China shaped a great portion of Biden's foreign policy as he sought to counter Beijing's growing influence in the world. As a result, disputes such as those on Taiwan, trade, and technology escalated. President Biden even angered his European allies when in September he announced an alliance with Britain and Australia meant to help Canberra build nuclear-powered submarines in the Pacific. The U.S. drew a Pacific ally closer to meet the China challenge, but at the cost of a 2016 deal being scrapped between France and Australia. Furious France called the deal a betrayal that had been secretly negotiated for months. The U.S. move further increased the push within the EU that the bloc needs its own independent military force, with member states aiming to agree on that in March 2022. To counter Beijing, Washington also put more focus on Africa, pledging to boost development in the continent where China already made investment and concluded trade agreements. The U.S. remained at odds with another power in the East, Russia. In addition to several rounds of sanctions over the alleged poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny, Washington sparred with Moscow over Ukraine too. It accused Moscow of preparing a war on its neighbor, ignoring repeated calls by Russia to stay away from near its borders. Cuba and Venezuela were targeted too. Sanctions against the two Latin American countries remained in place and even intensified over their internal policies. Iran was not an exception either. While it was trying to resolve issues surrounding the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 Iranian deal. But allies in West Asia had a different place in the U.S.'s foreign policy. political and military support for Israel continued, despite the regime's atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. And American ties with Saudi Arabia were warm, despite Biden's election promise to punish the kingdom for the 2019 murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Biden had also pledged to help end the Saudi-led war on Yemen, but despite that, he continued to approve weapons sales to the Saudi government, making the conflict drag on and resulting in more atrocities and war crimes. On Syria, the U.S. pursued this policy, keeping forces there on what Washington called an advisory mission to support Kurdish fighters battling the Daesh terror group. However, the American forces and their military bases came under attack on various occasions. The attacks happened amid calls for the U.S. expulsion from Syria, mainly over civilian casualties caused by American operations. Similar calls also grew in neighboring Iraq, where the U.S. finally ended its combat mission and limited it to an advisory one. And in Afghanistan, the U.S. implemented President Biden's so-called policy of ending forever wars. America fully withdrew from Afghanistan in August, following a sweeping takeover by the Taliban, the same group Washington toppled when it invaded the country 20 years ago. Biden defended his decision to end the Afghan war as he faced widespread criticism at home and abroad over the pullout marked with chaos and deadly violence. He also remained adamant to unblock frozen assets for Afghanistan under its new rulers, leaving that country alone to deal with all the ruins left behind from the longest overseas war in U.S. history.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Over the last 20 years, the United States has conducted more than 93,300 airstrikes in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen that killed between 22,679 and 48,308 civilians. According to figures recently released by AirWars, a UK-based airstrike monitoring group, the total number of civilians who have died from direct violence in America's wars since 9/11 tops out at 364,000 to 387,000, according to Brown University's Cost of War project. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Norman Solomon Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "The Pentagon's 20-year killing spree has always treated civilians as expendable." Stay tuned for more. Top U.S. officials once Americans to believe that the Pentagon carefully spared civilian lives while making war overseas. The notion is pleasant, and with high-tech killing far from home, The physical and psychological distances have made it even easier to believe recent claims that American warfare has become humane. Such pretenses should be grimly laughable to anyone who has read high-quality journalism from eyewitnesses reporters like Anand Gopal and Nick Terse. For instance, Gopal's article for the New Yorker in September says the other Afghan women is an in-depth, devastating piece that exposes the slaughter and terror systematically inflicted on rural residents of Afghanistan by the U.S. Air Force. Terse, an incisive author and managing editor at Tom Dispatch, wrote this fall, "Over the last 20 years, the United States of America has conducted more than 93,300 airstrikes in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen that killed between 22,679 and 48,308 civilians, according to figures recently released by AirWars, a UK-based airstrike monitoring group. The total number of civilians who have died from direct violence in America's wars since 9/11 tops out at 364,000 to 387,000, according to Brown University's Cost of War project. Actually, those deaths have been completely predictable results of U.S. government policies. And in fact, evidence of widespread civilian casualties emerged soon after the so-called War on Terror started 2 decades ago. Leaks with extensive documentation began to surface more than 10 years ago, thanks to stark revelations from courageous whistleblowers and the independent media outlet WikiLeaks. The retribution for their truth-telling has been fierce and unrelenting. WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange is in a British prison facing imminent extradition to the United States, where the chances of a fair trial are essentially zero. Former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning spent 7 years in a military prison. Former U.S. Air Force analyst Daniel Hale, who revealed the murderous effects of U.S. drone warfare, is currently serving a 45-month prison sentence. They had the clarity of mind and heart to share vital information with the public, disclosing not just mistakes, but patterns of war crimes committed by the United States of America. Such realities should be kept in mind when considering how the New York Times framed its blockbuster scoop last week, drawing on more than 1,300 confidential documents. Under the big headline, "Hidden Pentagon Records Reveal Patterns of Failure in Deadly Airstrikes," the Times assessed U.S. bombing in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan and reported that since 2014, the American air war has been plagued by deeply flawed intelligence, rushed and imprecise targeting, and the death of thousands of civilians, many of them children. What should not get lost in all bold-type words like failure, flawed intelligence, and imprecise targeting is that virtually none of it was unforeseeable. The killings have resulted from policies that gave very low priority to prevention of civilian death. The gist of those policies continues, and so does the funding that fuels the U.S. nonstop militarism, most recently in the $768 billion National Defense Authorization Act that spun through Congress this month and landed on President Biden's desk. Dollar figures are apt to look abstract on a screen, but they indicate the extent of the mania. Biden had only asked for $12 billion more than President Trump's last NDAA, but that wasn't enough for the bipartisan hawkery in the House and Senate, which provided a boost of $37 billion instead, actually factoring in other outlays for so-called defense. Annual U.S. military spending is in the vicinity of $1 trillion. Efforts at restraint have hit a wall. This fall, in a vote on a bill to cut 10% of Pentagon's budget, support came from only one-fifth of the House and not one Republican. In the opposite direction, House support for jacking up the military budget was overwhelming, with a vote of 363-70. And last week, when it was the Senate's turn to act on the measure, the vote was 88-11. Overall, military spending accounts for about half of the federal government's total discretionary spending, while programs for helping instead of killing are on the short rations for local, state, and national government agencies. It's a destructive trend of warped priorities that serves the long-term agendas of neoliberalism, aptly defined as policies that enhance the workings of free market capitalism and attempt to place limits on government spending, government regulation, and public ownership. While the two parties on Capitol Hill have major differences on domestic issues, relations are lethally placed beyond the water's edge. When NDAA cleared the Senate last week, the leaders of the Armed Services Committee were both quick to rejoice. "I am pleased that the Senate has voted in an overwhelming bipartisan fashion to pass this year's defense bill," said the committee's chair, Senator Jack Reed, a Democrat from Rhode Island. The ranking Republican on the panel, Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma, chimed in, "This bill sends a clear message to our allies that the United States remains a reliable, credible partner, and to our adversaries that the U.S. military is prepared and fully able to defend our interests around the world," unquote. The bill also sends a clear message to Pentagon contractors as they drool over a new meal in the ongoing feast of war profiteering. It's a long way from their glassed-in office suits to the places where the bombs fall.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and since most of the Christian world is celebrating Christmas today, we join them in their hour of joy by reflecting upon a wise saying of Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, regarding the mission of the last and greatest of divine messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as mentioned in the Gospel of St. Barnabas. The disciples answered, "O Master, who shall the man be of whom you speak? We shall come into the world." Jesus answered with joy of heart, "He is Muhammad, messenger of God. And when he comes into the world, even as the rain makes the earth to bear fruit, when for a long time it has not rained, even so shall he be occasion of good works among men, through the abundant mercy which he shall bring. For he is a white cloud full of mercy of God, which mercy God shall sprinkle upon the faithful like rain."
V.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We are going to talk on the importance and significance of consultation in Islam. Consultation is an important thing to be done by each and every individual in his life, because a person cannot rely always on his own understanding and on his own perception of things, or maybe on his own opinion. Okay, he has to go out to other people and seek their advice. And that's why the concept of consultation, or you call it shura or mashwara or istishara, is highly important in both the Quran as well as hadith. There is no doubt as to the fact that through consulting with others, many personal and social problems are resolved, aren't they? Of course, they are. And when two people talk about an issue, the combination of two thought patterns acts like the coming together of two wires of different charges, which gives light to the environment. So this is indeed what we can say about the significance of consulting others. When two opinions come together, out comes an opinion which is more solid, which is stronger, which is more reliable. God Almighty describes the religious and faithful people in one of its verses. It says, وَالَّذِينَ اسْتَجَابُوا لِرَبِّهِمْ وَأَقَامُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَأَمْرُهُمْ شُورَى بَيْنَهُمْ وَمِمَّا رَزَقْنَاهُمْ يُنْفِقُونَ. So it is verse 38 of chapter 42. Now the translation of this verse, I could roughly translate it like this: وَالَّذِينَ اسْتَجَابُوا, and those who respond to their Lord, وَأَقَامُوا الصَّلَاةَ, and keep up prayer, who consult among themselves, وَأَمْرُهُمْ شُورَى بَيْنَهُمْ وَمِمَّا رَزَقْنَاهُمْ يُنْفِقُونَ, and who give out to the poor part of what we have given them. So this is one of those verses of the Quran which describes religious, faithful, and practicing believers, mu'mineen, as I read the verses. We understand that both wisdom and narrations combine to indicate the sensitive position and significance of consultation, our aql, the faculty of intellect, and also the narrations, as well as the Quran, which is the most authoritative in source. All of these point to the significance of consultation. So we come to understand that it's always better for Muslims, but not obligatory, of course, to make use of this Islamic command, which is the very basis of prosperity and social improvement, consulting others. Consulting other people, experts, and of course we need to consult them.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
For example, I, as a student of religion, I need to consult a doctor in matters related to health, to hygiene, and a doctor as an expert of medicine needs to consult a jurist in matters related to fiqh, to jurisprudence, to legal issues. So everybody needs to consult everybody else, you know, in matters in which he does not specialize. Now, the Prophet, I gave one example of the Prophet consulting other people in his lifetime. Of course, now I would like to give you some more examples. And these are examples which have been documented in reliable sources and narrated on the authority of different sources. The Prophet, peace be upon him, used to advise people to have consultation. And when he advised other people to consult, he himself also made use of the same command. He also consulted other people. For example, in the Battle of Badr, prior to the confrontation with the enemy, he consulted with his followers, with his ashab, and with his companions. He asked their opinions about the combat with Quraysh, you know. Shall we advance? Shall we confront the enemy? Shall we return back? What do we have to do? So he consulted the Muhajirun, the immigrants, and the Ansar, of course. Of course, these two groups of people were always there with the Prophet. They presented two different views, but the Prophet accepted that of the Ansar, you know, about confronting the Quraysh. And also there was the Battle of Badr. The elders, you know, during this battle, the elders believed that they must stay in Medina in order to, you know, defend their strongholds by throwing arrows and stones from their strongholds and rooftops of their houses. But, you know, some young companions of the Prophet and some young men of the city of Medina preferred confronting the enemy outside the city. So the Prophet, what did the Prophet do? The Prophet preferred the advice or the opinion of the youth. And so the Battle of Badr took place outside the city. When we put the matter to our own wisdom, and we just think of this issue of consulting, or let's say have the example of a war, is it good to allow the enemy to come all the way, to come into your city, into your home, and then fight? Or you should fight the enemy before they enter the territory, the your land, or even your hometown? Of course, if we look at concrete examples, and if we look at the result, we see that it's always recommended that you fight the enemy before they enter your hometown. In the holy war of Taif, the Prophet consulted his commanders, his officers, and those who were in charge, you know. Some were saying, okay, we have to change the location, the headquarters. Some, you know, said, we do this and that. You know, the Prophet consulted them. That's what matters a lot, you know. Welcome to your program For a Better Life. In the consultation session, it's common to express differing views. You know, some views are in conflict with some others. each person tries to defend his own ideas and to condemn those of others, there must be a strong moderator or a manager present who could gather all views, sort them out, and adopt the best view out of them. You know, the Prophet of Allah, he was the wisest person, but even then he consulted his companions, and that's why the Quran says, وَشَاوِرْهُمْ فِي الْأَمْرِ فَإِذَا عَزَمْتَ فَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ. There's no doubt that the Prophet was connected to Allah. He was the Prophet of Allah. But even then, the God tells the Prophet, after you consult them, especially in the matters related to war, then فَإِذَا عَزَمْتَ, after you are decided, then you have to leave the matter to God and then go ahead and do tawakkul and consign your matters to Allah. So this is what we all have to do, you know. After consulting, we shouldn't stop there and do nothing. We have to go ahead after we are advised. So the person, the people, you know, mu'minin, should follow suit. Just as the Prophet sought other people's advice, we should also consult other people in matters which are important to our life, to our faith, and to the faith of the society. Obviously, there is also another important example. For example, the Holy Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him and his family, consulted his companions and his followers about the peace treaty of Hudaybiyah, which is one of the most important events that took place in the lifetime of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. And everyone was opposed to peace. You know, we should fight the enemies, we should fight the idolaters, the pagans. But then what did the Prophet do after consulting all the followers? He decided that he should have a peace treaty with the pagans. He signed a peace treaty with them, and it proved that the treaty was in the best interest of Muslims. That's why the Quran says, وَشَاوِرْهُمْ فِي الْأَمْرِ فَإِذَا عَزَمْتَ فَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ. Of course, we should always consign our matters to Allah, and we should put our trust in Him. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
After almost 2 years of isolation due to the coronavirus pandemic, Mexicans are once again celebrating Christmas together in a fair in the capital, Mexico City.
It is a joy that we've been planning for a long time to go out and to take this picture, because we've been locked up for 2 years and we couldn't go out. Now there's green light. We decided to go out with the whole family to live these moments together.
A few things are different in the fair as far as Mexican tradition goes. Santa and not the traditional three wise men give out presents. Families also have their photos taken by the Father Christmas. These are rare moments amid the coronavirus pandemic. The attendees say the situation is complicated, but they will try their best to make it work. The festival has been made possible by the introduction of green passes, which indicate full vaccination against COVID.
Scientists have made a stunning discovery inside a fossilized dinosaur egg, an embryo that's been preserved in a perfect shape. The embryo was found inside a 66 million year old fossil in a museum in the Chinese city of Guangzhou. Paleontologists say it's the best dinosaur embryo ever found. They're hoping it would help a lot in finding the links between modern birds and dinosaurs. The fossil belongs to a toothless oviraptorosaur, a group of feathered dinosaurs that used to live in what's now Asia and North America. The embryo is nicknamed Baby Yin Liang after the Chinese museum that houses the fossil.
Exchanging gifts is an inseparable and also the most joyful part of Christmas traditions. How about sharing the joy with animals? Now, a zoo in the Colombian city of Cali is doing so by giving presents to its animals. The presents are actually the animals' favorite foods served in a different way. Animals spend time unpacking the gifts decorated in Christmas theme, and then access the food they like the most. Feeding in this way arouses the animals' curiosity and fills them with excitement. Zookeepers say they want to show that animals always receive care at their zoo.
It is a very cool way to generate empathy for visitors. Although animals do not know that it's Christmas or that it's a special date, it is important to generate that message in visitors that we make care of our animals, and that for us it is important to share with them this Christmas season.
The zookeepers say they make use of enrichment strategies for their initiative. They actually stimulate the behaviors of a range of animals, even the species they keep in an aquarium. Running a marathon is pretty tough for most, but a group of people has upped the ante to take the competition to sub-zero temperatures of Antarctica. 62 people descended on the Union Glacier from around the world and ran over a 42-kilometer course. The area is just a few hundred kilometers from the South Pole. Soft snow and temperatures as low as minus 15 degrees Celsius did not stop Latvia Evia Rain from setting a women's record. The event was delayed for several days because of a massive storm that battered the area a week ago. Adventurers and athletes have been putting their strength to the test in the race every year since 2005. A tiny baby mouse deer takes its first steps into the world with a round body and spindly legs in a Polish zoo. It was born on December 2nd and now stands roughly 10 centimeters tall. The Warsaw Zoo got its first mouse deer last year and a second one last summer. Zoo staff are surprised that the pair of new arrivals have produced offspring so quickly. Mouse deer are among the smallest mammals. Even as adults, they only weigh around 2 kilograms. Contrary to their name, they are neither from mouse nor from deer species. Some mammalogists consider them living fossils because they haven't evolved much over millennia. Beachgoers in Brazil's Rio de Janeiro have been surprised by very rare visitors, a family of orcas. The family of three was seen swimming in shallow waters of a crowded beach south of the city. The group didn't seem to care at all about the presence of people on their paddleboards. Footage of the orcas quickly spread on social media because they don't usually come that close to the coast. A local biologist says the whales were likely to drawn. They were likely drawn to the area by a cold current from further south.
What we see in the video is a family group that has a male and a female who have a calf. It is common that the orcas come from a colder current where there is also a shoal, and they reach the south, the north in fact, and end up hitting our coast. Then they rest in warmer waters such as Copacabana Beach, Ipanema Beach, and Barra da Tijuca.
The biologist says the mammals pose no risk to humans despite the label killer whales. He says there is no record of their attacks on humans. Researchers suspect that the migration patterns of whales could be influenced by climate change and the resulting changes in water temperatures.
customers in a high-tech way. That's what a traditional restaurant in the German state of Bavaria does. What's the goal? The owner explains.
We decided ourselves for this robot because of the lack of staff. We looked for support in a technological form. It's not a replacement, of course, but it's a relief for the waiters.
The robot is equipped with a trolley and it can easily move around in the restaurant. When it comes to saving time, the high-tech waiter is of great help, especially when the restaurant is packed with customers. The owner says most customers first become surprised when they come across the robot. He says waiters are still present to serve meals and receive orders.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Butterfly gardens are a place where you can watch these tiny creatures and marvel at their beauty. But have you ever wondered where these butterflies come from? These colorful creatures are in fact bred in butterfly farms. And Donald Orsay from Costa Rica is one of the biggest breeders, making that the mission of his life. He produces somewhere around 2,500 pupas per week. Arce is one of the world's largest exporters of the popular Morpho species. Listen to him explain why he is fascinated by them.
A Morpho has a great advantage. It is a butterfly that rarely stays still, unless it is very late, because when it is getting dark, it settles down, but normally it flies constantly. It flies by in the butterfly gardens.
Arce's butterflies have their own special diet. They feed on bananas and a concoction that he keeps its ingredients secret. Morphos are popular because of their color. They are shimmering blue on one side and brown on the other side. That's perfect for camouflage. Butterflies are really fun to watch, but they serve a critical purpose as well. They help plants reproduce by pollination, thus strengthening the ecosystem.
A few hooks and a shelf have transformed a wall in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, into an outdoor charity. It's called the Wall of Kindness, which is painted with the slogan, "Grab a jacket if you need one, leave a jacket if you can spare one." Here, people can donate their winter clothes or warm boots if they have some extra. The Wall of Kindness is meant to help those in need, including the homeless, to stay warm. The wall was set up by a real estate company, and the organizer says people have responded positively with the high turnover. The move was inspired by a trend that has been seen in Iran over the years. Several other countries across the world, such as India, have also organized similar outdoor charities.
Scientists in Brazil have come up with a creative way to shore up the population of a majestic species of monkeys in danger of extinction. Brazilian conservationists have constructed a bridge to reconnect the two sides of Rio de Janeiro's Atlantic forest. The road had effectively isolated a group of lion tamarins, but now it offers hope for the endangered monkey. There are only 2,500 golden tamarins left in the wild, all of them in Brazil. It is estimated that these animals have lost more than 95% of their habitat.
Childhood joy and lightness meet with art at the first of its kind museum in Rome, Italy. Here, all kinds of art decorations are made of balloons. The exhibit, dubbed Let's Fly, displays a broad range of interactive artworks. In one installation, visitors are invited to find their inner child by diving into a pool of hundreds of small balloons. In another section, giant inflatable sculptures double as a playground for kids. Some installations move only by riding a bicycle. The museum is a place where artists and spectators coexist for a journey into a world of inflatable art capable of feeding the imagination of all ages.
It's the combination of art with childhood and adolescence that makes this place so magical. So they are art installations, but also games. The blurred line between the two is what makes the museum so unique.
The balloon exhibit incorporates innovative works created by 14 different artists from across Europe. The artifacts were created using hundreds of thousands of biodegradable balloons. The organizers say they want to increase environmental awareness by being eco-friendly, as all the artworks will be reused or recycled. The exhibit will run until March the 5th.
As people around the globe are preparing for the New Year holidays, the Vatican lights up a Christmas tree and nativity scene set up on St. Peter's Square. People gathered around the square waiting for long hours to see the illumination. Even heavy rain did not stop them. That's while the official lighting ceremony was held inside the Paul VI Hall, where Pope Francis presides his weekly audiences. The nativity scene, made of more than 30 pieces, is created by Peruvian artists. The majestic Christmas tree is about 28 meters and comes from Andalo, northern Italy. The locals see the stunning tree as a symbol of hope and peace. The tree will be switched on every night until January the 6th. Chinese students receive a science lesson on their country's space station, and they are lucky enough to receive it firsthand from the astronauts living in the first and core module of the station. The class was held via a live broadcast shown on the state television. The three astronauts gave a lecture that focused on physics. They explained how the weightlessness environment affects the movement of objects. The astronauts also gave a tour of the station they arrived at in October for a six-month stay. It seems that their teachings were quite motivating. The students peppered their instructors with questions, including those about living conditions in space. China launched its space station in April and plans to complete it by the end of the next year. Christmas is just around the corner, and children are waiting for their presents. In Guatemala, Santa Claus has a new mode of transport to give gifts to children with cancer.
Today, as in the past year, we are celebrating Christmas with the cancer patients of the shelter. Santa Claus came in a helicopter to give presents to the children. It is very emotional for the children. The majority of them have never been so close to a helicopter, let alone Santa Claus.
That was an exciting experience for the children. The charity event was organized by an institute that supports cancer patients for remote areas in Guatemala. The institute says the event aimed to help the children go through their therapies with more ease.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding.